Little sound check. Am I good in the back there? Okay, good. I see nods. I'm not going to use any visual aids today. I'm just going to speak from notes. And probably I should have some visual aids, but I never have time to put it together. And actually that's one of the points I want to make today, is that for politicians, the scarce resource is time. As a physicist, I was always worried about making a mistake. I was a theoretical physicist, so I was always worried about making a mistake in my calculations or in my computer program somewhere. But in politics, I'm always worried about not using my time well. So I give talks, but I never make slides, because not because I don't want to, but I never have enough time to put together something that's nice. It's an honor to be here. I was looking at the list of colloquium speakers, and being a physicist, I recognize some of the names, and it's quite a distinguished list that I saw for this season. So I feel very, very honored. How many of you have listened to like a minister give a speech and wondered, like, what did that person say and why did they need to take so long? I'm gathering by your laughter that you've heard these sort of speeches. So this is going to be an academic style speech. So I want to encourage everybody to interrupt me, raise your hand and ask questions. And I don't have anything in particular that I absolutely have to say. So I don't mind if people raise questions and kind of direct me in one way or another, and I'm very, very happy to entertain questions at any time, so just don't be shy. My talk will be in two parts. One is just to talk about my own experience, to kind of give you a sense of where I'm coming from and what I can claim to speak authoritatively about. And the second part, I think, is important because it's action items for you. It's what I think that you should be doing to make sure that, but to try to see that scientists have more of an influence in the political world. And there are other professions that do have much more influence than scientists do. I mean, if it's very easy to point to lawyers and teachers and doctors and firefighters and police and unionized labor. All of these groups have much more influence in the political world than scientists. And I don't think it should be that way, and I want to suggest some things that you could do about it. And I think it is very important for the government to have a lot of scientists there, and not only the government, but for the political world to have scientists there saying, hey, wait a minute, if you look at it this way, we should be really doing this instead of that, or such an issue should be given more weight if you're trying to balance a number of different things. So it is important for the government to have an evidence-based approach to policy and have politicians in there to kind of push that way of doing things. And that's not always the case. And as I was walking up to the, walking here today to the building, I was reminded of an incident only a few weeks ago when from across the benches, from the government back benches, one of the members stood up and made fun of the Liberal Party by calling it the Professor Party. So it's strange but true, but it's also sad that there's a feeling that if you call somebody else a professor, that you can take votes away from them. It shouldn't be like that. Let me talk a little bit about my own story, and I'm going to concentrate on the political part of this story. If you remember from the introduction, I started out, did my PhD in physics, did 5 years of postdocing, and then went into the financial world for 9 years, and I ended up as a manager of a group in the financial world. But I did move away from that, got married, had a kid, and took a few years off to be a stay-at-home dad. My wife went to graduate school. In 2006, the Liberal Party of Canada had a leadership campaign. It was a very open leadership campaign. There were a lot of spots for people to participate and get engaged in because there were a lot of viable candidates in a nationwide campaign. And one thing that I want you to know about that was that it was a lot of fun to work with people, because first of all, it's a lot of fun to work with people in the same political party, because you tend to have similar views, although you don't agree on everything. but you certainly respect each other's views, and you have a similar approach to things. It's even more fun when the party breaks up into different camps, each supporting different leadership candidates for different reasons, because then you're working with a group of people who very, very much look at things the same way that you do, and it's so fun to work with them and work with them on a team towards a common goal. And you really meet like-minded people. And I'm saying this because I want to encourage you to get involved in something like that. After the leadership campaign, I stayed on. That was the first time I'd ever gotten involved in a political party. And I just jumped right in. And the lesson is, you should feel free to jump right in, too. Don't feel shy. After that, I stayed on as the Riding Association president for Kingston and the Islands. Riding Association treasurer for Kingston and the Islands. Nobody wants to be the treasurer. So the lesson there is if you like numbers and you don't mind dealing with numbers and sweating the details that one needs to do as treasurer, you can get your foot in the door. It's something that people with quantitative backgrounds, like scientists, it's a way for them to get their foot in the door. In 2010, my predecessor, Peter Milliken, who's the longest serving speaker in the House of Commons, announced that he was not going to run again, that he was going to retire. So there was a contest in Kingston and the Islands to become the next Liberal Party candidate in the next federal election. That was in 2010. And so I was one of the people who decided to contest that nomination. I think that the important thing about that, that was then that I learned that if you want to do a political campaign, it's really consumes almost all of your time, and your family has to be totally behind you because it's a sacrifice for them too, because you're not there. That's the important thing to know about politics, is that it takes a lot of time. And that's one of the reasons, I'll get back into this later, that's one of the reasons it's hard for people on a scientific track to really devote a lot of time to politics. The other thing I want you to know about nomination contests is related to the second theme of my talk, is that contests to determine a party's candidate in an election, those nomination contests, that's a place where you can get involved and have a lot of influence. And I'll just throw out a couple of numbers. In a general election, in a riding, your vote is one out of maybe 60,000 votes. It's not, you know, one vote is not that much in a general election. When I ran to be the Liberal Party candidate for Kingston and the Islands, something like 2,000 people voted in this internal Liberal Party contest. So your vote is one out of 2,000, much more influence. And if you look at Calgary Centre, which had a nomination a contest for the eventual winner who was with the Conservative Party, or if you look at Toronto Centre, which had a nomination contest to pick Chrystia Freeland, the eventual winner. In those nomination contests, I believe something less than 1,000 people voted in the nomination contest. So that is an area that where you can have a lot of influence, because your vote counts for a lot more. And also, in these party contests, any party member can vote. And to be a party member, you don't need to be a citizen. You just need to be a resident of Canada. And you only need to be 14 years old. So it is an immense opportunity that people generally don't know about for influencing the choice of MPs, the political process. In a lot of ridings, and I bring out Toronto Centre and Calgary Centre because those are ridings in which a lot of the choice was made in the nomination, because those were nominations of the parties who were most likely to win the actual by-election. So it's not just the first part of a two-stage process. Actually, the nomination contest is where the decision is really made on who is the next MP. And not that many people participate in it because not that people know about it. The next thing I did in politics in 2011, of course, was the election that you know did not go well for the Liberal Party, but I had a lot of help from a lot of people in Kingston and the Islands. I think that I was viewed as a different kind of candidate with a different background, and I think that helped a lot. I think that scientists getting into politics right now will all have that advantage, that I think people are generally a little bit cynical about politics, and if they see somebody who's very different, and I look different with my Asian face, but I also am very different with my science background, and I think that helped a lot to say, well, you know, we want a big change, and here's a guy who looks like a change. And who really, and I would like to say who really is a change. So I had a lot of help from scientists and engineers in Kingston. I grew up in Kingston. I have really close connections with Queen's University. And it was very important to have a lot of scientists and engineers who were excited about this candidate who was a physicist and who got involved and donated and volunteered their time and talked to their friends and helped me out. That is also something I will get back to later about how scientists as a community can have more influence. One interesting story I want to share about the election was I got some really good advice from a veteran politician who had never lost an election campaign in decades. And he told me, Ted, don't spend too much time talking to professors. You know, that's the temptation if you live in the center part of Kingston and you're near Queen's University and you know a lot of professors personally, or they know my parents and stuff. There's a problem, but I think it's a revealing as far as how I think scientists should try to contribute. The reason why this friend of mine said that was he said, you know, you can go and talk to a professor and they'll want to try to understand where you stand on every issue and why and try to get background information. You could talk to this person for an hour and they still won't vote for you. This gets back to the importance of time management. A lot of voters just want to see you and look you in the eye and shake your hand and say a couple words to you to see if they trust you or not. And in the hour that you spend talking to one professor, you could talk to 20 or 30 or 40 voters. And what matters is voters, it's not professors. So that's something that I learned, but that poses a problem. You know, as a scientific community, as professors, as academics, how do you have influence in the political process if you're not great in numbers, and politicians know they should not be spending too much time talking to you? What are you going to do? And so I want to answer that question later on. So in 2011, on May the 2nd, people tend to remember their election dates. On May the 2nd, I was elected as the Member of Parliament for Kingston and the Islands. I have to say a couple of things. One is something that I've learned throughout a number of career transitions is that there's a lot of smart people out there. And they're not all in science. They're not all in academia. There's some extremely smart people who may not be as educated as you are, but are nevertheless extremely smart. And you have to recognize that and be prepared for that. I was helped very much after I was elected as a Member of Parliament by the other members of the Liberal Party, the other MPs who got reelected, and the staff on Parliament Hill. Being a member of the same political party means all these other people want you to succeed and want to help you do the best that you can. And so I benefited a lot from the mentorship of people in my party. And that's one of the advantages. I mean, people talk about a lot of the disadvantages of political parties. You know, you're forced to follow the party line, perhaps against the wishes of your constituents. But having members of a party work together as a team is very, very important. And I've learned a lot. I've been able to climb this steep learning curve because my fellow members of Parliament and Liberal staff members were so generous with their time and their advice. And I have benefited a lot from that. So I am currently the Liberal Party's critic for science and technology and post-secondary education, as well as economic development in Ontario. And so that allows me to work on some policy goals that I think are very important. I have enjoyed very much trying to make the case for funding basic research. I am very interested in economic development, especially on unlocking the value that we get out of our laboratories, the discoveries in our laboratories. And I'm interested in getting young people to be more interested in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, trying to make sure that government policy is based as much on evidence as possible. And I really enjoyed, you know, coming here to Toronto last week to the Canadian Science Policy Conference. And I really felt like, oh, this is like, these are people that I enjoy being with and talking to and working with. So, so that's a little bit of my background. Now I'm gonna make sure I have a. When did we start, and when do I have until? Okay, so I'm gonna finish well before 5 because I always find that having a lot of questions and answers is fun and gets is a good thing to do. So let me get to the second theme of my talk, and which is what do I want to tell you to do in order to increase the influence of scientists in federal politics or in politics at any level. I'm gonna if I could get a water or something like that. The first thing to do, I think, is to understand the importance of communications. And this is something that you can certainly do as an academic without diverting yourself from what you should be doing as an academic. And I think as a graduate student, I was just meeting with the graduate students. As a graduate student, you could work very hard on your communication skills, and that will help you for the rest of your career and will not get in the way of what you should be doing as a graduate student. I think it's very important to take your time and do a good job writing papers. Take your time and polish your oral and visual communication skills. To learn how to write like journalists, I think, is an important skill to have. I want to tell you a story that I got from Preston Manning. Preston Manning, as you know, was involved in founding the Reform Party. And so he's politically not aligned with me, but he has been very interested in getting more scientists to run for office. And I really remember this thing that he said once, which is that scientists and engineers, if they have a problem, they will look at the problem and figure out a solution and then implement the solution. It sounds very logical. But he says, when they get into politics, you have to tell them there's an extra step. You take your problem, figure out the solution, and then you figure out what subset of the solution you can communicate to people. And then you just implement the subset. And the reason for that is in a democracy, you can't do things that that people don't understand or you can't explain to people. But the corollary is, the better you are at communicating things, the more you can get done. And I think that's true of any large institution where you've got to get a lot of people aligned on something. The better you can communicate, the more you can do. And that is not just trying to figure out how to explain something, but it's also understanding what people's values are and how they respond emotionally to what you're trying to say. It's a bigger task than you think, and I always give this example, which I did earlier, that in question period, when I get the chance to ask a question, you get 35 seconds to ask a question, and usually you give yourself 30 seconds because you want some time to breathe and speak your words carefully. So you get about 30 seconds to ask a question, which means you get about 3 sentences. If you want to be, if you want people to understand what you're saying, and I usually take 1 or 2 hours to put together that 30 seconds of text, and the reason for that is that it's very, very important to make sure that every word and every inflection is chosen in a way to economize on the time that you have. You have only 30 seconds. You've got to give a sense of the background of some issue. You've got to criticize the government or ask a question to the government, and you want to make sure that you touch certain emotions or get people to think a certain way when they hear the question. So it takes a long time to craft these questions, and that's an extreme example, but I think that just gives you an illustration of the importance of communications in politics. The second thing I want to suggest is that as a group, that scientists be multi-partisan rather than non-partisan. A lot of groups are kind of afraid. They don't want to upset anybody. They don't want to get on the wrong side of the government of the day. So they try not to be offensive to any political party. They try not to be on the side of any political party. And that's one strategy. But I think it's important for any group, scientists in particular, in order to be politically connected, you have to be connected to the base of every party. And I have a real life example of a group that is multi-partisan and is very successful in being connected. And it's a very innocuous group. The name is, every year in Ottawa, there's something called the Conference for Advanced Life Underwriting. It's just a group of financial advisors. But I remember being told by the party leaders, Ted, okay, you gotta go. We need a liberal presence at this reception. You've gotta go and shake hands and meet people and introduce yourself. And I remember thinking, what is this thing? It's Conference for Advanced Life Writing. Why do I care about that? But then I found out, usually every year either the prime minister or the finance minister goes to speak to this group and the leader of the opposition goes to speak and, our leader can't make it, so we're sending our finance critic. It's very important to be there. How could these guys have so much influence get so much respect from the different political parties? Well, it turns out that this group is what I would call a multi-partisan group. They encourage their members to get involved in different political parties. So if you go there, you'll meet liberals and NDP and conservatives, and they are campaign managers and fundraisers and donors and very involved in supporting candidates to win election. But people can choose their own party. They support whatever party they really believe in. So it's not a non-partisan group. It doesn't shy from supporting one party or another. It's multi-partisan. And I have found that it is a very well-connected and it's a group that commands attention from politicians. And it seems to be a good model to try to follow. The problem is that for scientists is that scientists are generally very busy. So that's the problem. It's hard for scientists to spend a substantial amount of time away from research, especially as a candidate, where if you were a candidate, you might have to spend a whole year campaigning, and at the end of that, you still might lose and not have a job. And then after that, it's very hard to get back into research, to get writing papers again and get grants and put together a research group and get your equipment going. It's very hard for scientists to leave research and go back. So what can you do as an academic scientist, for example, to get good people to run, to get scientists and engineers to run, to help them get elected, to help them once they get in, and to have fun doing it all. And again, I want to remind you of what I said earlier about nomination contests. The contest to choose nominees for parties to run in the general election, that's a kind of small, self-contained area in which one person can have a lot of influence. There are standard things, like you can support candidates with money and organization, door knocking. I think door knocking is really important. And the reason why I think door knocking is important is that if you understand voters and how they vote, I think you understand almost all of politics. But that's a non-trivial thing that I'm saying, understanding how voters vote and why they vote the way they do. Knocking on doors is a way to communicate with an unbiased sample of voters. So if I were to sit in my office as an MP and wait for people to contact me, I would get a very biased sample of people. It's people who have a particular problem and are upset enough and want to contact their MP. It's not an unbiased sample of the voters in the riding. So that's why it's important to go door to door. Phoning is not so good because then you don't talk to people who have cell phones. You've got to go door to door. You've got to go at different times of day. You've got to go to different parts of the riding where different groups of people live, in order to get that unbiased sample. And you've got to have a sense of what voters think and feel. And if you help out in an election campaign by knocking on doors, I guarantee you, you'll get a sense of that you didn't have before about how voters vote and why they vote the way they do. I guarantee you, if you haven't done it before, it's a really eye-opening experience, and I encourage you to do it. Andrew Weaver, who some of you will know, is a physicist at the University of Victoria. He did that for Elizabeth May in the 2011 general election. Elizabeth May got elected. And he told Elizabeth May to her campaign, you know, give me the toughest part of the riding and I'll go and knock on doors. And he did. He knocked on a lot of doors. He actually got elected himself to the British Columbia legislature just this past year. So now I want to answer the question, what do you do if politicians know that they really should not be spending too much time talking to any one person? So how can you, as an academic or a scientist, have more influence? And I think the way to do that is to, you know, you think that politics is out there and there's people who know how to do it and you're separate from that group. It's not actually the case. It's actually hard to find good, reliable managers who will take care of something and you don't have to worry about it and it will be done well and reliably. It's actually hard to find good managers to run an election campaign. And that, I think, is an opportunity for somebody who is capable to try to influence politics. I have a friend who is originally from Calgary, but she ran for judge. She moved to Florida a long time ago, and she ran for judge in Florida. It was the first campaign that I worked on. I did the data mining and number crunching for her remotely. And she said to me, you know, after her first campaign, she said, you know, Ted, I really understand political patronage now. I really understand. Because it is so hard to find anybody who's willing to work on your campaign. And you are so grateful for anybody who does volunteer their time to do that. That you feel like you've got to do everything you can to help that person afterwards, after they've you know, made the sacrifice of time to help you. It is actually quite rare to find good people who are willing to volunteer and help out with an election campaign, and that's a way that you can have influence. I never, you know, and I personally, I always remember who were the managers of campaigns or did a lot of work to get me elected, and my door is always open for them, and I will always make time for them, even though there's lots and lots and lots of people who want to talk with me, and I have to say no a lot. So that's my answer to the question. Third thing I want to mention, and I'll try to end pretty soon, is to organize around issues as opportunities arise. And I want to mention a very successful, well, it's not the game, the story is not quite over, but I think that the uproar around the closure of the Experimental Lakes area in Northern Ontario is a very important example, because the people who organized the protest on the end of federal funding for the Experimental Lakes area, they, as far as I can see, they're just graduate students and postdocs and faculty biologists. But the people who organized that group, I think, learned what to do, how to organize and how to attract attention get some influence in politics very quickly. So we had tens of thousands of people signing petitions, and we had press conferences and a lot of MPs speaking about this this closure. I think that's an example of a successful protest, a successful organization around a particular issue. The Experimental Lakes area is particularly easy to communicate to people as well. You can just say, you know, this is a place where we figured out, we did the experiments to figure out the right way to regulate acid rain, for example, or to regulate phosphates in detergents. And people understand that when you can connect it with their everyday life. There's another sort of saying in politics that it's very important to remember, which is, if you are explaining, you're losing. So if you have to explain your position and the other side doesn't, then the other side is going to win the communications battle. And experimental lakes area was easy to explain. It's a lot harder to explain why, for example, NSERC should not be taking away from basic research or shutting down the research tools and instrumentation program and moving that money towards industrial academic partnerships. It's harder to explain why the government should be topping up NSERC to be able to do that. And you know that in mathematics even, elegant proofs are short proofs. So politicians are always constructing short narratives, and look out for those opportunities when you can do that. I think that, let me see, how am I doing on time? I think one thing that's important to do is for people to be better connected with scientists. And I think that every Tri-Council grant should come with extra money for every grant recipient to do public outreach. The Primer Institute has some percentage, I don't know what the numbers are, but some percentage of their budget is set aside for public outreach. And I don't see why every recipient of an NSERC grant shouldn't have some money and be told, you have to go and do public outreach. Very few people actually know scientists personally or have been told about a scientist's research personally. And because of that, I think that what scientists think or the scientific approach is not given enough weight when voters go and vote. And so I think it's very important to, and this is another reason why I think scientists, it's not good enough to go and talk to at the local science fair, because you're kind of talking to everybody, you're preaching to the choir in some sense. You've got to figure out who doesn't know about scientists and go and talk to them. I've heard one statistic once that I cannot find the original source for, so if anybody can find it, please let me know. But it was that only 18% of Americans know a scientist personally. And so, knowing somebody personally goes a long way to trusting that person. So if only 18% of Americans know a scientist personally, then scientists don't have much of an advantage when it comes to people trusting what they have to say. And quite often, scientific or technical issues in politics are complicated. And the average voter doesn't have the time. They have to go to work, take care of their kids, participate in their community, take care of their aging parents. They don't have time to figure out everything. So a lot goes on trust. And so a lot of good public policy relies on people trusting what scientists have to say. And if people don't know scientists personally, it's less likely that they will trust what scientists have to say. And so I think it is very important for scientists to go out and talk to people about what they have to do. I know scientists are busy, and that's why I personally think that there should be extra money or resources for scientists to do that. So let me just end with that, because I want to have plenty of time for questions. But I have a couple of other topics. So if you ask the right question, I'll get into that. Okay, I hope that's been helpful. But please ask me a question about anything. Yes. Well, I worked at Atomic Energy of Canada for a couple of years. So I've been through the process where your manager has to read through your paper and approve everything. I've never, if you're writing a paper on condensed matter physics, probably the party in power doesn't care too much. So I've never personally had that experience. But I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, I had a paper and some non-scientist reworded the conclusion in a way that I didn't like it to be done, or stories like that, and you've heard other stories in the news. So I think muzzling scientists, government scientists, is happening. But let me tell you a couple of things about this. First of all, this is an issue that's very easy to communicate. You can just say, scientists should be free to talk about their research. It's free speech. And it's about nature. Like, why shouldn't you be free to talk about nature? What are you afraid of? So, you know, that took only about 10 seconds, right? People get it. It's a good issue from that point of view. It's really easy to communicate. And we've been doing that for a number of years, and that gets you a certain distance. More recently, something came out which made it even, which allowed us to go a step further politically. So what happens was that is that the union that represents scientists, actually all professionals, that work for the federal government, did a survey. And about 4,000 people who work in science in the federal government responded to this survey. And they asked one question, which was a very politically smart question to ask. And they found that 50% of the respondents, so 2,000 scientists in the federal government, said that they knew of instances where political influence, or political interference is the word they use, political interference in scientific work put Canadians' health and safety at risk. So they were smart enough to ask that question, and they got 50% of scientists said they knew of cases where that had happened. Now, when something touches on the health and safety of Canadians, then as a politician, I can take a big step. I can stand up and say, I can talk to every soccer mom, and I can say, look, 2,000 federal government scientists say they know of cases where political interference in scientific work put the health and safety of your children at risk. So I can't stand up and say, you know, I didn't have that statistic. So that's an example of how if the right fact comes out, you can make political progress. And what happened there was that I was able to, and it's not me, it's whoever wrote the question, was thinking about tying this issue of muzzling scientists to something that people care a lot about, which is health and safety. And they used those exact words, and the results came back, and I was able to, in the House, make that point. And I think it's a very strong point to make, and we can keep pushing in that area. I mean, the problem is right now in Ottawa, it's very hard to talk about anything and to get it in the papers because of other things that are going on, as you know. And the only thing that can eclipse that is what happens in Toronto. So unfortunately, I haven't really been, you know, that hasn't gotten out very far, but I think it is a good example of how progress in politics can be made without having an election. Choose someone. Well, for that particular one, I told the reporter, yeah, I support it, so I don't just say that, because as a different political party, I'm supposed to contribute something, and so what I said was, I think it's a good idea, having a parliamentary science officer, but then I also said, you know, if scientists want to contribute to public policy, to setting public policy, I think it's important to have a science advisor on the government side who can speak confidentially and participate in the hard political decisions where you have to make choices and provide scientific input, but also provide it on a confidential basis from somebody who has the same political alignment so that a science person can have input in policy. So I said it complements the role of what I thought a science advisor should do. Generally speaking, I think parties tend to fight each other a little bit more than they need to, from my taste. And I would say Kennedy Stewart is generally very much less partisan than other people in his party, and I'm much less partisan than people in my party, so we get along really well. but it's, on the other hand, it is kind of our job to contrast, to provide alternatives. So we are always trying to provide an alternative, and so I supported his idea, but I said, in addition to that, there's this other feature. To get back to the more general question was, how do you balance loyalty to the party and what you think is the best fact? I think, for me, I kind of have a personal answer, which is that I believe, in my party, I've never had a situation where if I had a good argument or some fact to contribute, that it wasn't heard. So I haven't had that problem yet. I think when you're in government, you probably will have more of a problem, because then you've actually got to choose between A and B, and do you put X dollars here or two times X, you know, you have to actually make those choices. So maybe the things will change after the next election when we're elected. But right now, I haven't ever. If the party has chosen something where my preference would have been to do something different, I've never felt that the other side didn't have good arguments. One thing that I did when I started out running for the Liberal nomination was I kind of set out why I wanted to run in words, explicitly. And I also said that I'm setting this out because I want to explain when I will support the party and when I will not support the party. And what I said was, if I don't support the party, it's because the party is going against something that it's going against the reasons that I wanted to get into politics in the first place. So I'm willing to exit politics for something, in order to support an idea or a principle that caused me to go into politics in the first place. So one of them, for example, is one of the things that interests me a lot was trying to get the country to do something more about climate change. So if I ever feel that the party is going backwards on climate change, or is not willing to do something which I think it has to do, and you know, there's lots of choices to be made, you know, that's a case where I will say no, and I have to vote against the party here. And so there's things like that. So I think it is very important for somebody to know why they want to get into politics. And one of the benefits of that is it's going to be very easy for me to decide when to go against the party or not. The other important thing about this, knowing why you want to get into politics, is if you don't know, see, the way things work is you need a lot of, the parties need a lot of people to working to get elected. So if you want to get elected, a lot of people have to do a lot of work, and you rely on them. And to some extent, you're indebted to them for doing all the work that needs to be done to get elected. And if you don't know what you want to do when you get into politics, you can be controlled by that group, or people with other agendas who are just using you to get somebody elected. And if you know what you want to do when you get into politics, then I think you're much less likely to be controlled by the backroom of the party who really just wants to get into power. Everybody's a little combination of both. So the extreme is somebody who just wants to get into power and doesn't care about anything. And the other extreme is somebody who has absolute positions on certain issues and doesn't care whether that means they win or lose votes. Everybody is some combination of those two. Some people are 90% just want to get into power. Some people are 90%, I have these absolute positions on certain issues and I don't care if it wins or loses votes. If you don't want to get taken over, you need to know why you're getting into politics in the first place. Sorry, and that answer was too long.
One of the sad facts of Canadian politics is that the Red Guardian Canadians, of course, two progressive parties, your party and the NDP. Is there any chance that these two parties could work together if they were not for government?
Okay. Well, so let me answer that question. And this is being recorded, as I was told. But I'm used to that. I assume that anything I say anywhere is going to be recorded. I've had that experience before when secret recordings were made of other people's speeches, and then I had to go and fish out a recording to put something that was taken out of context back into context. So let me give you a number of answers. First of all, I think my personal preference for the best way to deal with that is to change the electoral system. And my personal preference is to change that to a preferential ballot where you list, you know, what's your first choice, what's your second choice, what's your third choice. Because if you do that, then the parties can, they can advocate for their own positions and fight each other. And in the end, they don't get in each other's way because of the preferential ballot. And also, parties will be much nicer to each other because they'll want the supporters of the other party to choose them as their second choice. That's my preference. As far as cooperation between, say, the Liberals and the NDP, I'm generally in favor of that, and I certainly, in the Liberal leadership race, the most recent one we had at the beginning of this year, I supported one of the contestants who wanted to work with the NDP to try to win more ridings. But I have to say that the problem with the Liberals and the NDP working together are there's some serious cultural differences between the two parties, and I don't want to get into that. And I'm not saying that one's better than the other, but there's definitely some cultural differences. And what's another problem is that I think voters, Liberal voters and NDP voters, they get along fine. I think there's problems with people who have been working for the parties for a long, long time that they personally just don't get along. So, you know, they fought a lot of election campaigns against each other and they just hate each other after a number of them. That, to me, would be one of the hardest parts of getting the parties to work together. It's an unfortunate consequence of our competitive electoral system. I don't see any how it could be any other way but competitive. But I think the easiest thing to do would be to reform the electoral system, because then the parties could fight as much as they want without getting in each other's way. And preferential ballot is a way. I like to think of it from an economics point of view. Preferential ballot is the way to ask voters for more information, because they not only just vote for one person, they're asked to rank their preferences. And what could be better than asking voters for more information, right? It is very useful. I mean, but the important thing is don't bother writing the Prime Minister, because the Prime Minister gets a lot of letters. Write your local MP. And you know what they say, all politics is local. I'll tell you this. If I get 5 personally composed letters on any issue, I consider that an important issue. It's very rare, actually, that I get 5. I get, quite often there'll be some issue where people have filled out an internet form and I get 500 copies of the same letter. And quite often I'll look at that and say, well, okay, it's just the usual activists. But if I get 5 personally written letters from 5 different people on a particular issue, then I would definitely pay attention to that. I would not say that for a minister who would be getting thousands of letters from somewhere. But for me, if I get 5 letters from my constituents, I think that's pretty significant. And I would definitely spend some time thinking about whatever they wrote in on. It could be a cultural thing. I don't quite know, but I don't know for sure, but my guess is it's a cultural phenomenon. I don't really have any more data to I don't really have any data to back that up, but that's my guess. Well, I think in any situation, it's important to understand what the person cares about and to look for, if you want to come to some agreement, figure out try to figure out a win-win situation. Try to figure out what you can give the other person, what they want, what they need. I think in business people do that all the time. Try to understand why, what the other person needs, and try to find an accommodation which benefits both sides. I think that's a good way to do it. I have to say that one thing I found in the business world is that disputes are resolved much more easily than in the academic world. Because in a financial world, you could have these enormous fights over $1 million, and people know that, you know, if you keep fighting, you're both going to lose. So you split the difference somewhere. And sometimes in the academic world, I find that, and you might know that sometimes disputes are over very little things, and those disputes can be very hard to ever resolve, and they can become very bitter. And the financial people is like, okay, you know, I don't really hate you, or I'm fighting very hard with you, but it's not about you. It's about what piece of this $1 million I get. And it doesn't get personal, and it's like, okay, well, let's sit down and work something out that benefits both of us, because we have to do business together in the future. You know? And I don't know, my sense is sometimes in the academic world, you have these very large fights over things that are hard to divide up. And so it becomes much more bitter. And I just found that disputes in the financial, when I worked in the financial world, were much easier to resolve. The important thing of having different MPs is what they contribute to the party caucus. So the time when different members of the same party fight it out and have that discussion and try to influence other members is in these caucus meetings. Or, you know, just informal meetings between members of the same party. When it comes time to voting, we tend to vote together because we want to make sure that the identity of the party is clear. But I think it's very important, and people don't, this is not done in public, so people don't know about this so much. But we really, there's quite often times when issues come up where the Liberal caucus is split down the middle. And we have these very intense discussions, emotional discussions. But in the end, we make a decision one way or the other, and we all agree to support that. The reason for that is that, you know, sometimes you have to support something that somebody else likes and you don't. But you know that the time will come when they will support something that you want to do. And so if you vote together as a block, you can get more done. And it's important to realize that function of parties and that ability of parties to bring different interests together. A lot of policy choices are made within parties in the Canadian system, where you have very strict party discipline. My preference would be if the party discipline were less strict. But I think it is a good mechanism for hashing out policy differences between different regions or different parts of Canadian society. To hash them out within parties. And there is definitely a lot of disagreement and discussion that goes on, but there's a lot of advantages in terms of getting things done by, at the end, okay, once you take a decision, okay, everybody supports it. Because sometimes you support something you like, sometimes somebody else supports something that you, sometimes somebody doesn't like something but supports it because you supported them on something else. And that's how you build a consensus. Yeah, I think that you know, my own personal style is to be a lot less partisan than the average MP, and it's because I believe that's the way it should be done. And I think that more people will vote if if some of the partisanship were removed. But I don't think that's the whole story. I think that one of the areas that I'm trying to concentrate on is to try to get more young people to vote. So young people only vote like between age 18 and 24. I think the turnout rate is 30-35% or something in a general election, whereas the overall turnout rate is something like 60%. And if I go to a senior's home, I know that 80-90% of the people are there are going to vote. And that makes a big difference on what you talk about in or what kind of legislation comes up in Parliament. So if I want to get something done on climate change, for example, it's hard to do when young people don't vote. If you take polls, like they do these school polls. At the last election, they polled students in high schools and even elementary schools, and the Green Party would get like a quarter of the vote. So, you know, young people care a lot about the environment. And it's very hard to even push my own party in that direction when young people don't vote. So for me, that's a priority. I take the time to go to elementary schools and to talk to grade 5 civics classes. Not because they could vote, because they can't vote for a long, long time. But I want to try to get them excited about politics and understand the importance of the federal government so that the first time they have a chance to vote, they will vote. And studies have shown that if young people vote the first chance they get, that they will continue to vote for the rest of their lives at a very high rate. So it's very important to get young people when they're young and say, you know, you've got to vote.
Okay, I think we should wrap up now.